Benjamin Franklin, sure, considered by some to be one of the greatest scientists this country has produced. Of course, you know he's best known for his kite-flying experiment, but he was just one of many people of that time investigating the strange powers of electricity and trying to figure out what could be done with electricity. Michael Brian Schiffer has written a book about those early days of electrical discovery. He's a professor of anthropology at the University of Arizona in Tucson and author of Draw the Lightning Down, Benjamin Franklin and Electrical Technology in the Age of Enlightenment, published by University of California Press. He joined us in our NPR studios in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. If you'd like to talk about Ben Franklin with us, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Put this in context for us a little bit. When did Franklin do most of his seminal work on electricity?
Well, it was actually a fairly short period. It was from 1747 to about 1753. And at the almost at the beginning of that period, he published a small book that set forth his one electricity theory. And also he explained the operation of what was then called the Leyden jar, which today we call a capacitor. Mm-hmm. And that had an enormous influence almost immediately on other natural philosophers of that time who were interested in electricity, because it explained things that no other theory could explain, and it was a very fruitful theory that led to all sorts of new experiments.
What did people think that electricity was pre-Franklin?
Well, the major counter theory was proposed by a Frenchman named Nollet, and it was that there were two electricities, one that issued forth from an object that had been charged and another that came to that object. And these were used by Nollet to explain attraction and repulsion of mm-hmm. charges. And the attraction and repulsion, of course, was only one small set of effects that electricity had. And some of the other ones were far more interesting, and those are the ones that Franklin's theory explained extremely well.
Tell us about a few of those.
Well, the capacitor, Leyden jar of that time, was basically a glass container that had metal foil on the outside and metal foil on the inside, or water or some other conductive material. And if you charged it up by connecting it to what was then called an electrical machine, which was a frictional generator, then it would acquire a charge, sometimes a very large charge. And the question was, how did it do this? And some people thought that it was a matter of the charge being stored in the water or other conductors. Mm-hmm. But Franklin did a really ingenious experiment. He used a Leyden jar that had water on the inside. He charged it up, and he poured the water into another Leyden jar that hadn't been charged. And if, of course, the water held the charge, then the new Leyden jar would also be charged. But he found out that it wasn't. And he did a lot of other experiments to demonstrate that the charge actually resides in the non-conducting material of the glass. That was a startling discovery.
And he said basically that all of electricity is the same. You don't
right.
have these different kinds of electricities running around.
You don't have different kinds of electricity, but you have electricity in two different states, which he called positive and negative, mm-hmm. or plus and minus, which are terms still with us today. And he said that you could, every object had sort of a natural state of electricity that had these charges in equilibrium. And you could disturb that equilibrium by creating an excess of positive or negative charge. And that's what happened with the Leyden jar and other capacitors. There was a disequilibrium created in the charging process. And and you could remedy that disequilibrium by putting your hand on the inside and outside of a Leyden jar, and you could get knocked on your butt.
You do that only once, yes. And so basically when he talked about these two charges, when he talked about this famous kite-flying experiment, it was to prove that the same charges existed in the clouds and they could be brought to Earth, and they were just an imbalance of the charges.
Exactly. He extended his ideas from his laboratory to the cosmos, and he proposed an experiment that would test this idea. The idea that electricity and lightning were the same was an old idea by the time Franklin took it up. Mm-hmm. But what he did was say, look, this is a great idea. There are lots of similarities between what's going on in the lab electrically and what's going on in the cosmos. Let's figure out a way to test that conjecture that these are the same. And so he proposed the idea of taking a long iron rod and erecting it on an insulating pad of resin and waiting for thunder clouds to approach. And the idea was not to be hit by lightning, but simply to draw down some of the charge that he believed resided in the atmosphere and especially in clouds. Well, before he himself undertook that experiment, investigators in France, Dalibard and others, contrived a version of that experiment, and it was immensely successful. They were able to draw sparks from the iron rod that in every way looked like the sparks that were created by an electrical machine or a Leyden jar. And so this experiment became famous very fast and was known as the Philadelphia experiment because Franklin had suggested it. So by the time Franklin did the kite experiment, this was already superfluous in the sense that the other experiment had demonstrated the identity of electricity and lightning. And he had proposed that experiment, so he got a lot of credit for it. And that's that was the context in which he did the kite experiment. He didn't actually know at the time that the other experiment had been done first. It was done the previous month, and of course communication wasn't so swift in those days.
But it made him a hero in France, did it not?
It did, absolutely. And we forget that Benjamin Franklin had the ear of the French court, not because he was such a great diplomat and carouser, but because he was a famous scientist, and science was highly valued in the French court.
And so he was able to go ask for help where he had been turned down before. Well, had he not been turned down an audience before? And now he was pretty famous.
Yes, it was his fame as an electrical scientist that helped him secure support for the American revolutionaries.
And out of this came one of his first inventions, the lightning rod.
Yes, that was actually, he invented that in 1850.
Yeah.
But before the kite experiment in 1852, and it was published first anonymously. But it was his invention, and some people believe it was the first practical invention to come out of pure science. Hmm. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But it's a good story.
Well, he's certainly the first American scientist for the colonists. You know,
he was truly
American scientist.
Yeah, he was a world-class scientist. If there had been Nobel Prizes in that time, he would have got one. He got the Copley Medal from the Royal Society in London, which was a very prestigious medal. He also got honorary degrees from Harvard and Yale.
Well, we're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with Michael Brian Schiffer about Benjamin Franklin and his book, Draw the Lightning Down, Benjamin Franklin and Electrical Technology in the Age of Enlightenment. Enlightenment. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about early electrical technology and the people who used it. My guest is Michael Brian Schiffer, professor of anthropology, University of Arizona in Tucson, author of Draw the Lightning Down, Benjamin Franklin and Electrical Technology in the Age of Enlightenment. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Michael, what was going on? Was Franklin the only one fooling around with electricity there? And after he worked with the Leyden jar, it gave people, I guess, sources of electricity, like a big battery to experiment with. What kinds of experiments were they doing?
Well, they were doing all kinds of experiments, some of which we would today consider to be pretty bizarre, and others which led to really important technologies, both in science and other contexts. One of the first attempts to apply electricity was in medicine. And this began in the 1740s. And I have to insert a correction here. I've been saying sometimes in the 1800s. And the reason is I'm now working on electrical technology from the next century.
You've gone into Thomas Edison realm from the...
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So anyway...
I'll jump on it next time. Go ahead.
Okay. The medical applications were very widespread. You could actually go get electrical treatment by a lot of electrotherapists in London, for example, in the late 1700s. And, for example, they would stimulate muscles that had atrophied somewhat from accidents or from paralysis. And over long periods of time treating atrophied muscles with electricity, you could get the muscles to respond. Mm-hmm. And this technology of applying electricity to stimulate atrophied muscles is still important today in medicine, and that was basically discovered in the 1740s. Another medical application was an extension of that, and that was to stimulate heart muscles in an early version of emergency medicine. And there was even a device that was commercialized in England that could be used if you were attempting to revive the so-called apparently dead, somebody who had drowned or fallen off a horse or something like that. And there are actual accounts of successful revivals of people using cardiac stimulation with this technology.
And they, what, they had a charged up Leyden jar and with the paddles on it, sort of?
Yes.
Something like that?
Yeah. They didn't use paddles per se, but the Leyden jar was the immediate source of the electricity that was applied. And it was only one of a range of techniques that people were using at that time. They were used by societies called humane societies that began in the Netherlands and spread widely over Europe and into the colonies. Hmm. There was a Humane Society of Boston, one of Baltimore.
So there was a lot of experimenting, just pure experimenting going on.
Yeah, because electricity provided people with tools for doing all kinds of things, some of which they'd done before and some of which they hadn't done before. In chemistry, for example, electricity gave people a new tool of analysis and a new tool of synthesis. And using electricity, Henry Cavendish discovered that water, which had to that time been considered an indivisible element, you know, earth, water, fire, so forth, he showed that it was actually made up of two colorless, odorless gases. So, you know, the stuff of oceans and clouds and living beings was compounded of two gases. That was a startling discovery that led slowly but surely to a lot of Lavoisier's new chemistry to a better understanding of lots of aspects of chemistry.
1-800-989-8255. Let's take a few phone calls. Cody in Sacramento. Hi, Cody.
Hi. Where does James Clerk Maxwell and his field equations play into this whole timeline?
Well, he comes about 100 years later. And he has at his disposal all the discoveries that were made in electricity stemming from the discovery of electromagnetism in 1820. So he's concerned with lots of other kinds of electrical phenomena, not so much with what was going on in the 1700s.
What, was Philadelphia a big center for a lot of research here in electricity and people getting together and chatting and comparing notes?
Well, there were some scientific societies that Franklin helped to establish, and electricity would have been one of the topics that people discussed. They were the American Philosophical Society was born then, and people could talk about or did talk about lots of things and had demonstrations of different scientific activities.
They also made a lot of toys, a lot of electrical toys, didn't they?
Yes, and Franklin himself was a great originator of these kinds of very strange objects that could do all kinds of things.
Especially shocking things, like...
Yes, well,
kissing
the electric kiss was a favorite, of course, where you charge this woman she is holding on to a conductor that people in the audience can't see, connected to a Leyden jar or something like that, and some unsuspecting male in the audience is invited to come up and kiss her if he can. So, you know, this guy strides up and, you know, goes to plant a big wet one on her, and before he can reach her lips, he gets the shock of his life and jerks back in total disbelief.
Wow.
And that was a great one for these public lectures. But Franklin also came up with, he didn't invent that one. He refined it so that the shock would be bigger. But he, but people did all sorts of things like, well, Franklin's things. For example, he invented an electric motor that ran on the charge from a Leyden jar, and it could spin around about 20 RPM. And he...
How would he keep it going? They didn't have electromagnets then, did they?
No, but it worked on the basis of attractions and repulsions of charges. It had it was a wooden wheel about a foot in diameter that had a vertical axle, and along the edges of the wheel, all around the circumference, were placed glass strips with a thimble attached on the end, and then there would be two Leyden jars on a table next to it, and then you'd kind of give it a little spin. And the thimbles would exchange charges with the knobs on the Leyden jars and be attracted and repulsed as they went around.
Interesting.
So,
genius.
And then he actually invented a version of that the rotor itself was a capacitor that held its own charge, and you didn't even have an external. Huh. Leyden jar. That must have just been mind-blowing to watch.
Were any of these things made into practical motors? Did anybody patent this stuff and sell it and get the rights and make some money on it?
No. Well, Franklin himself was dead set against getting patents. There was an English patent system before the Revolution, but to my knowledge, no electrical thing was patented in the 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
There were some of these objects were brought to market, in effect, by what were known as philosophical instrument makers. These were people who had expertise in working glass, working metal, doing optics, and making various kinds of mechanical devices that could be used in lectures in colleges and by these sort of itinerant lecturers. And they would keep an eye on the latest scientific discoveries and scientific technologies that people had invented, and then they would go ahead and bring them to market. But usually the inventors never got a royalty or ever thought to take out a patent. But it was through the scientific instrument makers that these things were available and widely available, because all the big cities in Eastern North America and on the continent had scientific instrument makers.
Interesting. Margaret in Chapel Hill, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I'm fascinated by this program. Benjamin Franklin has always been my hero. But I have a question about lightning rods. I want to know why modern houses don't anymore have lightning rods. I now sell real estate in Chapel Hill, and last week one of my vacant listings was hit by lightning. And it did damage to the house, but it didn't burn it down, and I just don't understand why it didn't burn it down and how it is that now, since we don't have lightning rods, that we're protected, or are we protected?
Well, that's a great question. In fact, lightning rods have never been really very prevalent. I think the reason is the same then and now. People don't believe that this kind of rare event is going to affect them. You can't really predict where it's going to strike. Except that if you have a tall structure, you're more likely to attract a strike. But perhaps today in our century, fire insurance helps.
If you go out in farm country, you see lightning rods all over the place. And tall buildings and barns and things like that.
You do see them, but they're not consistent.
Yeah. Yeah. Is the aim of the lightning rod to take the lightning stroke, or is it to draw off the charges as they build up in the atmosphere so that you never have the stroke?
Well, Franklin believed that both would contribute to the effectiveness of the lightning rod. The idea of it drawing off the charge harmlessly and sending it to ground, I think, just doesn't really work.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically admitted that in himself. But the way they work is, if you get hit, it will send the charge to ground because you're sending it through a really good conductor instead of your structure or your body.
Did I read that he had a whole system of bells in his house that would go off when lightning struck his lightning rods or something like that?
Yeah, he had a rod erected on his house, and the wire came down into a room, and then there was a bell on one end, and then another wire that went to ground that had another bell, and they were separated by a small gap. Right. So when there was a big surge of electricity, particularly a lightning strike, there would be, you know, a huge white spark going between the bells, and they would, of course, ring. But when there was just a lot of electricity in the atmosphere, they might ring, too. Hmm.
Okay, Margaret, are you going to get some lightning rods now?
It doesn't sound like it would really work all that well. But why didn't this house burn down that got hit by lightning, do you think? I mean, is there something in the electrical system that drains off the electricity and sends it to ground like a lightning rod would?
Well, I really couldn't say, not having seen the house. But this is actually something that people were doing after he invented the lightning rod. They would go around and they would look at houses that were struck by lightning and that were damaged or undamaged, and they'd try to see how it worked. So I can't speculate.
Maybe he just found a path to the ground, some other way. Maybe he hit an antenna on the roof and that went to the ground somehow.
It went through the electrical system and knocked out all the circuit breakers and stuff like that.
Well, yeah, that's grounded. The electrical system is grounded, so there's the path, you know.
So that would have grounded it, knocking out the circuit breakers.
Yeah, and it might still have gone through a relatively unconductive path and done some damage along the way.
Yeah. Oh, it did. But it didn't burn the house down, which was really helpful. I still have a house to sell.
Well, get those lightning rods. They do it. They work. Yeah. You know, you see the good houses. I see lots of houses with lightning rods on them, and a lot of them are the older ones.
Yeah.
You know, especially if it's a valuable house and you get that big piece of copper going into the ground.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Okay, thanks a lot.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. What was probably Franklin's greatest accomplishment? Was it, I mean, electrically, was it to prove that there was this, you know, one kind of electricity? And did that convince people to go ahead because he made that discovery and create their own devices?
I think that had that was a big part of it. I think that today we've forgotten that Franklin was a theorist as well as an experimenter. And that theory was the most productive theory of electricity in the 18th century, by far.
Mm. Talking with Michael Brian Schiffer about Benjamin Franklin and electricity on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow, and in a few minutes we have left, a lot of people want to talk about this sort of topic. It's quite interesting. He was a. Let's go to talk about with Pete in Walnut Creek, California. Hi, Pete.
Hi. This, of course, wonderful show. I wanted to say how clever your producer was in picking a piece written by Mozart for Franklin's glass harmonica.
Oh, you're listening.
Yeah. There's a lot of really good things that if you don't know it, you miss some of the really cool connections.
Well, that's interesting that you bring that up because Franklin had, and we'll talk about this a bit. It's not part of your work, Brian, but well, you know, he was interested in everything, right? He was studied ants. He studied making these glass harmonias. He studied the Gulf Stream, all kinds of things, didn't he, as a scientist?
Yeah, and that was actually fairly typical of the natural philosophers of that time. They were interested in all sorts of things, and you could move to the cutting edge of different fields a lot more quickly than you can move today. You didn't have to have a PhD in physics to do experiments. There were no PhDs in meteorology to talk about the Gulf Stream and so forth. So he did lots of different things and invented, of course, we know he invented lots of things as well.
The bifocals.
Yeah. And the Franklin stove, of course.
He was a printer. He was the post office guy. He
managed to be good at almost everything he did, which is really pretty astonishing.
And did he spread this out over his life, or were there little moments of productivity spaced around?
Well, he was most creative when he was in middle age, when he was wealthy and had the opportunities to do this. And then later on, of course, he got involved in diplomacy and serving in Philadelphia and then serving for the nation.
Did he have to put his career as a scientist on hold for that?
He basically did. The only time he jumped in a very serious, combative sort of way was when he defended the lightning rod against people who criticized the invention, even saying that it was dangerous.
Hmm. Now, you don't consider yourself a historian. You call yourself an archaeologist. Why is that?
Well, I was trained as an archaeologist in a department of anthropology, which most prehistoric archaeologists are in our country. But my interests have taken me to lots of strange topics that require me to look at historic materials. And I don't want to claim to be a historian because I think historians have a particular rigorous training. They ask certain kinds of questions. They know how to sort evidence and so forth. And I'm kind of an amateur. I don't want to claim the mantle of historian. I think that would offend historians. I'm just an archaeologist who is fascinated by the technologies that helped to create the modern age.
So you dig around basements and attics then looking for...
Well, I
have relics.
Done that.
You don't have a pick in the backyard underground anywhere.
No. You've probably heard of one of my dear friends and colleagues, Bill Rathje, who started the Garbage Project.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Drilling down
years
into
ago.
The garbage. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was he and I and other people at the University of Arizona in the 1970s argued that archaeology could do a lot more than just glue together old potsherds from Indian sites.
Well, good luck to you. We've run out of time. I'd like to thank you for taking time to talk with us.
My pleasure. It was fun.
Michael Brian Schiffer, professor of anthropology. He's an archaeologist, University of Arizona, Tucson, author of Draw the Lightning Down, Benjamin Franklin and Electrical Technology in the Age of Enlightenment. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk about another invention, the Xerox machine, and the tortured path to it. It's quite interesting. Stay with us.